As we continue in our summer series on legacy, we come this morning to Genesis chapter 37 and the beginning of the stories surrounding Joseph. And so I would invite you now to hear the word of the Lord from Genesis 37, verses 1 to 4, and then continuing on in verse 12. Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien, the land of Canaan. This is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he had made him a long robe with sleeves. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." He said, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron. He came to Shechem, and a man found him wandering in the fields. The man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." The man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, carrying gum, balm, and resin on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. This is the word of the Lord. When I first read the passage assigned for today in this sermon series, I thought, what in the world am I going to say about that? And then I realized, as it says in number one in your teaching notes, that just like Joseph, no one comes from a perfect family. None of us comes from a perfect family. I was reminded of this a couple of weeks ago when Betsy and I were on vacation in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and we visited the Norman Rockwell Museum. Many of you are familiar with Rockwell, who was famous for his illustrations of everyday life. And these illustrations appeared on covers of the Saturday Evening Post for nearly 5 decades. And one of the paintings that we saw as we were taking our tour was the one that's up on the screen from 1959, and it's called The Family Tree. And this is the family tree, and you may have some difficulty seeing it in such detail, but this is the family tree of that smiling red-headed boy up at the top. And his earliest ancestors, you'll notice, are at the bottom. And according to Rockwell, they are a pirate and a Spanish princess. And the pirate had kidnapped this princess from a sinking Spanish ship and took her to be his wife. And that began this family tree that ends with that red-headed boy. Now, this boy is descended from quite a cast of characters. And you'll notice that there are some Puritans in the family and also some wealthy aristocrats. Among his ancestors are someone that fought as a Confederate in the Civil War and someone that fought in the Union Army in the Civil War. And one of his great-grandfathers looks like a prospector. And the other great-grandfather was a preacher. And his grandparents on his mother's side look like a rancher, and his grandmother looks like a showgirl. And on the other side, sort of a happy-go-lucky, well-to-do couple. Now, the interesting thing is that all of these characters are in the DNA of this all-American boy at the top of the family tree. Now, looking at this, it makes me wonder, what will he be when he grows up? And then it makes me think, too, about your family tree and mine and the cast of characters that someone like Norman Rockwell might draw if they looked into our family histories. I remembered something that Dr. Martin Luther King once said. There is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us. And when we discover this, he said, we are less prone to hate each other. Some good in the worst of us, some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, we are less prone to hate each other. Now, you may not find a pirate and a princess or an outlaw and a Puritan in your family tree, but certainly there is some good and there is some not so good in every family. And this is certainly true of our earliest ancestors that we've been looking at this summer in the book of Genesis. We've been looking at Abraham and Sarah, at Isaac and Rebekah, at Jacob and Esau, and Rachel and Leah, Jacob's wives. And we've seen them at their best, and we've seen them at their worst. At times they are incredibly faithful, but at times they turn from God and behave very, very badly. But here's the thing we need to remember, especially when we look at stories like we're looking at today. And that is that while there are some good and some evil in all of these characters, God is always faithful. And from generation to generation to generation to generation, God continues to keep God's promises. This text from Genesis 37 begins the story of Joseph, which is really the longest story in the book of Genesis. It continues on for 14 chapters all the way to the end of Genesis. And if you sit down and read it in one sitting, it's like reading a novel. I mean, there are many adventures in this story. And throughout this story, the interesting thing is that the writer of Genesis shows us every character in all of their brokenness. This story lets us see these characters not as ideal saints, but as real human beings with some good in them and some evil in them. This story invites us, first of all, to remember Joseph's father, Jacob. In verse 1 we read, Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien, the land of Canaan. And this is the story of the family of Jacob, we're told. Now let's take a moment just to review what we've already learned about Jacob in the book of Genesis. First, as it says in your notes, Jacob never feels his father's love. Never feels his father's love. Genesis 25 tells us that his father Isaac loved his brother Esau more than him because Esau was a manly man who loved to hunt. And Isaac, we're told, loved to eat the game that Esau would bring home for him. I wonder what it was like for Jacob, growing up knowing that his father preferred his brother over him. Not only that, as we read on, we discovered that Jacob stole his father's fortune and his father's blessing. He tricked his brother into selling his birthright for a bowl of stew, and then he tricked his father into giving him the blessing that was supposed to be for his older brother. And of course, Esau is enraged, and Jacob runs away and goes to live with his mother's relative, Laban. And there, Jacob falls in love with younger daughter, Rachel. But Laban tricks him into marrying Leah. First, Leah bears Jacob 11 sons and 2 daughters, while Rachel is childless, but still, Jacob loves Rachel more, and everyone in the household knows it. So Jacob creates resentment in his household, favoring one wife over the other. If ever you needed an argument against polygamy, there it is. Not only that, he also creates friction in his relationship with his father-in-law. And he prospers at his father-in-law's expense. And if you go and look at this story in Genesis chapter 30, beginning at verse 25, you'll see that after Joseph is born, Jacob tells his father-in-law that it's time for him and his family to move on and make a life of their own. And then he convinces his father-in-law to let him take, in return for his many years of hard work, some sheep and some goats. And they agree that Jacob would get all the sheep and goats that have spots and stripes, or the black sheep, and that Laban could keep the pure ones. Well, Jacob comes up with a plan to deceive Laban, and I don't quite understand it all. I think something gets lost in translation, but the way it ends up, Jacob gets the strongest and best of the herd, and he leaves Laban and his sons with the weaker ones. And let's just say that he was not welcome back at his in-laws ever again. And as today's story begins, we discover that once again, Jacob is creating discord in the family, and that he loves Joseph, the child of his old age, more than his 11 sons and 2 daughters. Look again at the second half of verse 2 in today's text. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of two of his father's maids, Bilhah and Zilpah. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children because he was the son of his old age and he had made him a long robe with sleeves. Well, you remember that amazing technicolor dream coat that Joseph had. So Genesis is telling us about the brokenness of Jacob. And we might well ask why God would choose such a dirty, rotten scoundrel who played favorites and tricked people to carry on his legacy. Well, not to be disappointed, Joseph keeps the family tradition of causing trouble alive. And as we read on in this story, we discover, first of all, as we've already seen, that Joseph is the favorite son. But it's not enough that his father loves him more. He holds it over his brothers' heads. And there's some verses there that we didn't read this morning. And in those verses, we see that Joseph has these dreams. And in the dreams, he is greater than his brothers. Now, I don't know about you, but nothing made me more upset at my sister when I was a kid than when my sister told on me for something, and I didn't want my parents to know it. I won't go into the details. But Joseph was a tattler, and he also had these dreams that he was always holding over their head. Genesis gives us a picture of Joseph as a spoiled brat. So Jacob is broken, and Joseph is broken. And his brothers? Well, Joseph's brothers, you know, they grow up in a household of animosity, constant tension between Leah, their mother, and her sister Rachel, Joseph's mother. There's bickering and jealousy in the household that these boys grow up in, and it only gets worse. It only gets worse when Joseph is born. And as we're told, these brothers hate Joseph. They hate him and cannot speak peaceably to him, Genesis tells us. Hate him so much that when they get him by himself, they throw Joseph into a pit. And then these horrible events unfold. When Joseph came to his brother, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with the sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty, we're told. There was no water in it. They want to kill Joseph there, but Reuben, the eldest, keeps them from doing it, thinking of how it would impact their father. And so instead, they sell Joseph into slavery. And that's how he gets to Egypt. And then they deceive their father into thinking that Joseph is dead. Beginning at verse 32, there is such heartache. These brothers had the long robe with sleeves taken to their father, and they said, "This we have found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not." And Jacob recognized it, and he said, "It is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him. Joseph is without a doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "No, I shall go down to my grave mourning." Thus his father bewailed him. Now, perhaps like me, you remember hearing this story as a child in Sunday school. It's a story that no matter how many times you hear it, it's just jaw-dropping. To imagine your own brothers and sisters wanting you dead, throwing you into a pit where you might be eaten by wild animals or selling you into slavery. It's hard to imagine feeling so much jealousy and rage toward someone as these brothers felt toward Joseph. And I wonder, why does Genesis let us see all of these characters in such an unfavorable light? No family I know is as bad as Joseph's family. And yet, Genesis is showing us here that our families and our relationships can be weakened by the same things that weaken this family and its relationships. For all the good that we receive from those who've gone before us, we've also inherited some unhealthy traits that get passed on from generation to generation and harm relationships. Sometimes parents work out their unresolved issues in the lives of their children, and it impacts them for the rest of their lives. Sometimes a parent will favor one child over the others, and it creates such jealousy and tension in the household, and we experience sibling rivalry in our families too. Sometimes the behavior of our sister or brother causes us such grief. None of us comes from a family like Joseph's, but none of us comes from a perfect family either. But here's the question. Where is God in this story? You know, God is not mentioned at all in this entire chapter 37 of Genesis. Perhaps you've seen something like this, a string of letters together, and you're supposed to sort them out and figure out what sentence is formed there. And I wonder what you see this morning when you look at those letters. Well, there are two phrases that might stand out. And the first one is this: God is nowhere. God is nowhere. Someone has suggested that God is nowhere in this story, and it's on purpose because it shows us what can happen in our lives and in the life of a family when we live apart from God's love. And we might look at the horrendous things that people do to each other in this story and the horrendous things that people do to each other in the world today, and we might start to think God is nowhere. But thankfully, we know the God of Jacob and Joseph and his brothers. We've been focusing on God all summer long, and we know that God is faithful. Every one of our ancestors is a broken vessel, but every one of them receives grace. The marvelous grace of our loving Lord. And so we look at this story and we say, even though God isn't named, God is now here. God is now here. Beloved, I don't know where you might see yourself in this story. Whatever your situation with your family might be, whether you see yourself as Joseph in the pit, crying out for help, whether you see yourself as the brother standing on the edge looking in, or maybe Jacob the father overwhelmed with grief, thinking his son has died. Wherever you might see yourself in this story, I hope that you hear the good news that's here. For the good news is that whatever our circumstances might be, God is now here. And God is faithful. God is at work to bring about God's good purposes in spite of what we might do. And in spite of what our past might be. You might remember that several weeks ago I talked about Corrie Ten Boom. She was taken with her parents and her sister to a Nazi concentration camp for providing shelter to Jewish families during the Holocaust. And while her mom and dad and sister all died in the camp, Corrie survived. She addressed audiences all over the world and wrote some powerful books with the message of the forgiveness that is possible because of the gift of God to us in Jesus Christ. And I love something that Corrie once said. She said this, "Never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God." Never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God. As this scripture ends for this morning, we're left with a family that's torn apart. Torn apart by jealousy and hatred and grief. Joseph sold by his brothers into slavery on his way to Egypt. We're left with a whole lot of uncertainty about the future. And you and I, we live that too. The future for us is unknown. I'm not sure where you might be experiencing uncertainty in your life today, but I am sure of this. God is now here. God is faithful. And we need not be afraid to trust an unknown future to the God we know. The God revealed to us in Jesus Christ. The God who is even now moving in us and in this world to make all things new. You'll see a verse there from Proverbs at the very end of your teaching notes today. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5. And I would invite you to take this verse with you and repeat it often in the days to come. Let's read it together as we close our time. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not rely on your own insight. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will make straight your paths. Trust in the Lord. In all your ways, acknowledge Him. And He will be with you always. Amen.